This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
So I wasn't here last week, so we had a week off. Inshallah ta'ala, I'm going to try and get through maybe the negotiation period before we start the Ramadan prep. We're going to have a session or two to talk about inshallah Ramadan right before it. I'll announce inshallah the dates. It'll probably be the two Saturdays right before. The problem is that Ramadan is either the 11th or the 10th of March, which will make it a little bit difficult. Saturday, there is a possibility that one of the Saturdays, we'll start Tarawih on a Saturday. So I may end up doing it 3 weeks before because of that Saturday that I'm not sure about. But we still have this week and next week for sure. See you all, and then after that I'll make, we'll put out on the WhatsApp groups and we'll make announcements inshallah for the details. We are in the sixth year of his prophecy, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He's 46 years old at this point. And we've told the story basically up to this point. And the first 6 years of his bi'atha, alayhi salatu wa sallam, were definitely rough. The first three were quiet to a certain degree, where he was testing the waters, alayhi salatu wa sallam, choosing people, speaking to them, trying to build his core group. And to a certain degree, that was very successful. The numbers were not huge, but he was able to surround himself with people that were committed, that had grit, that understood the message, that were really willing to live for it. And once he went public, in the third year of his prophecy, alayhi salatu wasalam, it became a confrontation with Quraysh. Quraysh became, they were no longer neutral. They became confrontational, and they decided that they did not believe in his right to speak or to believe or to talk about faith in the way he was talking about it. You see, he wasn't bringing a new religion, alayhi salatu wasalam. This is an important piece for you to understand. Like, he did not bring Quraysh something that was they'd never heard of before. He was telling them, we have to go back to the teachings of our forefather Ibrahim, alayhi salam. That's what he was saying. He was telling them that what you believe in right now is not what Ibrahim and Ismail believed in. That's not what they lived by. And you know that, and they did know that, but they didn't want to change it because they felt that it's been so long. Ibrahim, alayhi salam, lived maybe 5,000-6,000 years before that moment. So for them, they're like, well, you know, all of our forefathers since then have lived like this, have been pagans, and they've accepted Asnam, and we don't want to necessarily change all of that. It was really for them about changing the status quo. That was their problem. I'm not sure if that's clear to everyone here. The status quo means the norm, how things are right now. They didn't want to change that. It didn't matter what he was calling them to change it to. They just didn't want to change how things were functioning right then, because it was working for them. They were making money, they had status, they had power, and they had pull. So for them, any change was going to be negative. Even though the Prophet ﷺ was bringing them back to the authentic, original belief that Ibrahim ﷺ had, and they knew it was correct, because when you read the Quran, وَلَئِنْ سَأَلْتَهُمْ مَنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَلَئِنْ سَأَلْتَهُمْ مَنْ خَلَقَهُمْ, if you were to ask the pagans, who created you, who created the cosmos and the earth, لَيَقُولُونَ اللَّهِ, they'll say Allah. طيب. Then why are we worshipping rocks? There's a system that allows that to be lucrative. There's a system that allows that to be beneficial and helpful for us. So don't stop saying these things. Stop trying to change things. Because it makes more sense, or you can make more sense of his story, if he brought to Quraysh something that was completely abnormal to them, or unheard of, or out of what they could possibly fathom or understand. If he did that, alayhi salatu wasalam, it would be more okay. I can understand Quraysh's skepticism. But because he wasn't doing that, because he didn't come and start throwing around physical miracles and asking them to do something that made no sense to them, he was just saying, we are all the sons and daughters of Ibrahim, and this is not what he lived by. And I'm taking you back to the Hanifiyyah. I'm taking you back to what he was about. But they said no anyways. And they didn't say no because of the fact that they didn't believe what he was saying was correct. It was more that you're shaking, you're rocking the boat. And this boat is a good one for us. We are the kings of the castle. We're on top of the hill. Why are you rocking the boat? That was Quraysh's problem. That was really their problem. So they persecuted him, as it happened for almost every prophet before him, alayhi salatu wasalam. He was persecuted, and not only was he persecuted, but his Sahaba were also persecuted, and his family, and everyone who decided or chose to believe in him or stand by him or support his message were tortured and treated and discriminated against and treated poorly for many years. And this is where we are in his story, alayhi salatu wasalam. Year number six. This discrimination and mistreatment will continue until he leaves till Medina. And then it'll continue even in the early years in Medina. It'll take a long time for this to stop. It wasn't like a year or two, you power through them. No, it was going to be the majority of his life story, alayhi salatu wasalam. The majority of his prophecy by far. It was only maybe the first 2 years and the last 2 years of his prophecy, alayhi salatu wasalam, that were smooth sailing. Everything else was very difficult. It was very, very difficult. And in the midst of all this persecution, in the midst of what the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam himself was enduring, physically, financially, socially, on a reputation level, psychologically, in the midst of what the Sahaba were going through, as they were being mistreated physically, financially, socially as well, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave them a little bit of a glimmer of hope. And we have the story of the two people who accepted Islam within a week of each other in the sixth year of his prophecy. That's all we really know. We don't know exactly when it happened, but we know that it happened in the sixth year of his prophecy, alayhi salatu wasalam. Sayyidina Hamza ibn Abdul Muttalib accepted Islam. And I told you his story last week or 2 weeks ago. And Sayyidina Umar ibn al-Khattab. And I'm going to tell you the story of Umar, and then I'm going to make a few points, inshallah, for reflection, because I think it's worth your time. Sayyidina Hamza's acceptance of Islam was spontaneous, it was immediate, it was a moment of heat, where he just was upset that someone was being oppressed and persecuted and mistreated, so he couldn't stand it, so he stood by the Prophet alayhi salam, even though deep inside he didn't believe in everything he was saying alayhi salatu wasalam, but he accepted anyways, just because he didn't like the fact that he was being mistreated. And then when he looked at the deen, it made sense to him, so he stuck to it. And he became Asadullahi wa Rasulihi, the line of Allah and his Prophet. And he became one of the most known names within our deen, one of the most beloved Sahaba that ever lived till this day. Sayyidina Umar al-Khattab was different. Umar had a whole different life story to begin with. So Hamza radiallahu anhu was very chill, was laid back, was the most eligible bachelor of his time. Umar was different. Umar was someone who was extremely motivated, very driven from a young age. Sayyidina Umar al-Khattab, not only was he physically superior to other people around him, he was also mentally and educationally as well. He read and he wrote, and he was someone who could articulate well, and he's someone who, once he believed in something, he dedicated his life to it. That's the type of person he was. So he believed in his family. He believed in his tribe. So he was the ambassador of his tribe to the different parts of Arabia. So he was someone who was somewhat of a known name. However, his tribe was not a big one. He had a small tribe. Bani Adi were not a big group of people. So he didn't have a lot of protection, unlike Sayyidina Uthman ibn Affan, who was from Bani Umayyah, which is the majority of people in Quraysh, and they were extremely well, they were armed, and they were well prepared, and the numbers were high. So he's well protected. Sayyidina Umar wasn't as well protected, but his reputation was strong enough that he could carry himself. And physically, he had that edge. He didn't like Islam up front because to him, the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam was changing the status quo that he, at that time, did not see a problem in. He had not seen the problem in the way things were running. I'm telling you his story, because if you understand his story, you can appreciate his character. And he's for sure someone who's worthy of study and understanding. In your life, you should definitely dedicate some time to understanding the genius of Umar ibn al-Khattab, for sure. So for him, he couldn't see why we needed to change things. So he didn't like the Prophet ﷺ doing that. So he actually participated in persecution, in trying to silence the Prophet ﷺ's message for the first 6 years. He wasn't as aggressive as others, but he was a part of that whole group. But because he traveled so much, it wasn't as clear. He tells us how he came closer to Islam, how he took his steps towards Islam. And I told you, I think I told you the first story last week. I can't remember, but I'll tell it again just for the sake of completion. So he tells us, these are his words. And there's a book called Istirdad Umar, written by an Iraqi author by Ahmed Khair al-Umari. It's not in English yet, but it's in Arabic. And if you read Arabic, it's a book totally worth your time to read. And it's Regaining Umar is the name of the book. And it's just a really beautiful, well-written book about his character. So he says, at the beginning, the first time I felt something about Islam is when I had a young servant in my home. She was a young girl, and she accepted Islam. And as I pointed out to you, a lot of the nobles of Quraysh, if someone in their household accepted Islam, that was seen as shameful. So they would especially torture them. So he was basically persecuting her, and she didn't budge. No matter what Sayyidina Umar al-Khattab would say, she only got stronger. And he would ask himself, what is it that this person? Why is this person doing this? Why does she care? I'm being very brutal. Anyone her age would have probably said, fine, take it. I don't want to do this anymore. But she didn't. She stuck to it. And she was actually mocking him. And he felt there must be something special about whatever it is that she believes in for her to act like that. But he just let it go, didn't think about it again. The second time he was doing tawaf around the Kaaba because he was waiting for a meeting, and the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam was praying in front of the Kaaba. And the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam was reciting from Surah Al-Haqqah. And Umar is listening. He would jog on the other side of the Kaaba and then walk slowly when it was walking around the Prophet so he could hear slow. And he was listening to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam reciting, and he couldn't make sense of what he was listening to. He hadn't given Islam the time yet. And the Quran is very powerful. To someone who understands Arabic and is well accustomed to Arabic literature and poetry specifically, the Quran is just very bizarre, for the lack of a better word. It was just very different. And it was extremely superior linguistically, very powerful in the meaning, very artistic yet extremely deep. And he couldn't make sense of what it was. Is it what is this? So he's listening to him, he's going around the Kaaba listening to him, and it's just very, in Surah Al-Haqqah specifically, if you've read it, it's just very beautiful. So he's listening to it, and then he says to himself, he must be a poet of some sort. Just as the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam in Surah Al-Haqqah was reciting, وَمَا هُوَ بِقَوْلِ شَاعِرٍ قَلِيلًا مَا تُؤْمِنُونَ. And these are not the words of a poet, you just don't want to believe. So he's like, well then, he must be a sorcerer of some sort. As the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam would recite the verse after that, وَلَا بِقَوْلِ كَاهِنْ قَلِيلًا مَا تَذَكَّرُونَ. Neither is this are these the words of a sorcerer, if you would only reflect on them. So then he said to himself, well, what is this then? As the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam would recite the verse afterwards, تَنْزِيلٌ مِنْ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. It is what has been descended from the Lord of everything. So he was shocked. It's as if the Quran was speaking to him inside his mind. It was like, this is too weird. So he goes. Second time. The third time, he's on the way back from one of his journeys, and he sees a lady on a camel with a young baby, and she's leaving Mecca. And he knows her, so he asks her, إِلَىٰ أَيْنْ يَا أَمَةَ اللَّهِ. Where are you going? In the middle of the nowhere, alone. Back in those days, it was dangerous. If you were a young person, or you were not properly armed, or it's very dangerous to travel. For a lady to travel with a baby, she's asking for trouble. She's going to get into trouble. So he's like, where are you going? So she said, أَفِرُّ بِدِينِي مِنْكُمْ. I am running away to maintain my freedom of religion from you and the people who are like you. So he felt very bad. The third time, this is what we've done. We forced a woman like this, a noble woman, someone who's respect. I've known her for years. We forced her to leave. She was leaving Mecca. She wasn't going to Medina, but she was leaving to go live with family because she couldn't stay in Mecca anymore. So he got really upset. So this lady would later on see her husband. And she would say, I met Umar ibn al-Khattab on my way here. He's like, well, how did you make it? Because he was known to be an opposer. He said, well, I said this to him and he let me go. I looked at his face and he was very upset when I said these things. I felt like I almost moved him. Like he was emotionally moved by my words. So the husband said, no, abadan. Wallahi la yuslimu Umar hatta yuslima himarul khattab. Umar would never accept Islam until his al-Khattab, his father. Until his father's donkey accepted Islam, he would never accept Islam. It's based on how he was before. But no, at that point, Sayyidina Umar al-Khattab radiallahu anhu, he was starting, his whole mentality was starting to shift. And then he says something happened where the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam was in a discussion, in an open debate, and he was pointing out how the Asnam are all made up, how they are not true, and he said things that bothered, that caused a lot of controversy amongst people, and he saw the controversy occurring within his family and with the people around him. So he said, you know what, I'm going to end this once and for all. And he went to his house and he took his sword, and he said, I'm going to go and I'm going to kill Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sahbihi ajma'in. So he's leaving, he's saying these words, and Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu heard him. So Abdullah ibn Mas'ud heard him say these things, so he's getting very, he's very worried, and I'll tell you where the Prophet alayhi sallam was in a moment. So he basically intercepts Umar al-Khattab as he's moving, and Umar al-Khattab is telling him, where's Muhammad? I want to go. So he tells him, well, before you go and kill Muhammad, maybe you go and you deal with your own sister. Your sister's been a Muslim for ages. Maybe go deal with her. And he said, Fatima bint al-Khattab radiallahu anha is the wife of Sa'id ibn Zayd, one of the 10 Mubashirin bil Jannah, one of the 10 who were promised Jannah by the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, and one of the earliest Muslims radiallahu anha wa ardaha. So he said, my sister? And he got all upset. So he forgot the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam for a moment, and he went to the house of his sister Fatima bint al-Khattab. So Fatima at the time was sitting inside her home with her husband, and they had just written down some verses that were revealed to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. Most narrations point out that it was Surah Taha. We don't know for sure, but that's what we think it most likely was. So they were sitting there and they're reciting Taha, ma anzalna alayka al-Qur'ana litashqa. They're reading them, and Umar al-Khattab comes and he hears them, you know, humming on the inside. So he pounds on the door, demanding that someone opens the door for him. And Sa'id is like, you hide the tablets. Hide them somewhere. Don't open the door. They're panicking. And then finally, he pounds on the door hard enough, and Sa'id opens after they hide the tablets. So he's speaking to Umar al-Khattab, this and Sayyidina Umar, he whacks Sa'id hard enough, he sends him on his back, and he tells his sister, give me whatever you were reading. You had something, you hit it, give me. I could hear the clanking of tablets. Where are they? They're not here, I don't have them. So he pushes his sister. He pushes her, radiallahu anha, she falls and she hits her face and she bleeds from the side of her mouth. He sees that, he feels guilty, and he calms down. He loved his sister and he felt bad. So he sat quietly, ashamed. And he says, just, I want to see what it is that you're reading. فَقَالَتْ إِنَّكَ مُرُؤٌ نَجِسْ قُمْ فَاغْدَسِلْ. No, this is, you're carrying najasa. You can't carry these tablets without, go take a shower and then come back. So he does. He goes, he does that, he comes back. He says, give me the tablets. So she takes out the tablets from under her pillow and she gives it to Sayyidina Umar al-Khattab radiallahu anhu wa'ala. So he recites, radiallahu anhu, طَاهَا مَا أَنزَلْنَا عَلَيْكَ الْقُرْآنَ لِتَشْقَى إِلَّا تَذْكِرَةً لِمَنْ يَخْشَى تَنْزِيلًا مِمَّنْ خَلَقَ الْأَرْضَ وَالسَّمَاوَاتِ الْعُلَى الرَّحْمَنُ عَلَى الْعَرْشِ اسْتَوَى لَهُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا وَمَا تَحْتَ الثَّرَى وَإِنْ تَجَهَرْ بِالْقَوْلِ فَإِنَّهُ يَعْلَمُ السِّرَّ وَأَخْفَى اللَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ لَهُ الْأَسْمَاءُ الْحُسْنَى طَاهَا. Indeed, we did not descend this Qur'an upon you for you to be miserable or for you to find only hardship. That's not why we sent this to you. However, we sent it to you as a reminder for those who have some reverence in their hearts towards Allah. Is descended upon you from the one who created the cosmos and the earth. Ar-Rahman. They love that name. The most merciful, the most compassionate. The one who offers compassion for all. Al-Arsh istawa, as he controls his throne. He owns all that within the skies and all that which is on earth and everything in between them and everything that is under them. And if you speak loudly, well, he hears that which is public and he hears that which you whisper. Allah, there is no God but him. And he has the beautiful names. That's the verses that he recited. He put down the tablets. And he turns to Sa'id, he gets them up. He tells him, where do I find Muhammad? So Sa'id tells him, he's in a place, he's in the house of Al-Arqam. We'll talk about him in a moment. He's at that house. Sa'id saw something, so he told him. So Sayyidina al-Khattab was still carrying a sword. He was in a little bit of a haze himself, and he was walking towards the house of Al-Arqam. And Abdullah ibn Mas'ud saw him coming. So he runs inside and he tells them, he found out where we are. He's coming. Umar is with here with his sword. Now who's sitting there? Hamza sitting there. So Hamza says, let him in. In ata li khayrin kana lahu khayr. When ata li ghayri thalika qataltuhu bi sayfihi. If he comes for goodness, then goodness he will find. If he comes for anything else, I'll kill him with his own sword. So everyone calmed down a bit. Sayyidina Umar al-Khattab would come and he would knock on the door. So the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam himself, they didn't know what happened at the house. So they, as far as they can tell, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud is telling them he was saying he's going to kill you, that's why he's here. So everyone was like, Ya Rasulullah, go into the back room. Go back, go close the door and stay there, we'll deal with him. So the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam goes and he opens the door himself. يقول عمر ففتح رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم الباب. He opens the door. فأخذ بتلابيبي. التلابيب is the, you know, how the discalabia works in the it's called a qamis by the way. This is what they used to call a qamis. It's called a galabia, but they used to call this a qamis. We call it a qamis a shirt these days, but that's what they used to call it. And telabib is where you put the buttons, so it's a little bit thicker, and there's a little bit of an edge or something a little bit more thick you can hold on to. قال فأخذ بتلابيبي. The Prophet عليه الصلاة والسلام put his hand and held me from here. قال ثم هزني. Then he shook me. وقال أما آن لك يا عمر أن تسلم. Has the time not come, O Umar, for you to accept Islam? قال ثم هزني. Then he shook me again. حتى سقطت على ركبتي. And then he shook me so vicious. I couldn't stand it. I fell to my knees. قال أما آن لهذا العقل يا عمر أن يشهد أن لا إله إلا الله. Has this mind not come to the conclusion yet of the testimony of the oneness of Allah, يا عمر؟ يقول عمر فقلت أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأنك عبده ورسوله. And he gave his testimony, he made his shahada radiallahu anhu. And the whole house of Dar al-Arqam began with takbir. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, celebration. This is a quote from Sayyidina Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. I love him in this story because he's kind of watching everything, he's giving the information. But then he's also someone who's very objective. He didn't let anything, the fact that Umar ibn Khattab was so aggressive bother him. ما زلنا أعزة منذ أسلم عمر. We have since been in a state of dignity the day Umar became Muslim. Imagine that. Imagine one person. One person has that type of effect on a community. I think about that a lot. It's such a meaningful thing. Because often as people, because the world, because now we understand, It's more now than it, I think, was before. Because today, we understand how big the world is. I don't know if they understood how big the world was then as much. Meaning, if you were to explain the planet and the number of people, I don't know if 1400 years ago they had the same comprehension that you do. Today, you can look, you can zoom out on Google Maps and just look at the world and imagine 8 billion. You don't even understand what 8 billion means. It's just a number. It doesn't matter. If I asked half of you how many people are in this room, you'd get it almost, you'll be off by maybe by 50% or 40%. It's hard. We're not good at estimating numbers in terms of people. We don't understand what 100,000 people looks like, or a million. Forget about 8 billion. It's huge, huge number, and it's all across the place, and everyone's focused on themselves. So you grow up with this feeling that, what can I possibly do? What impact can I possibly have in this world? And you just end up feeling a little bit less valuable, or less impactful, or less hopeful of doing something beautiful. Or having that value that we would all. And I just love the fact that this is a part of our story. That in one year, every single scholar of Seerah, in their books, they will specifically point out the year where Hamza and Umar accepted Islam as its own event, as its isolated incident. Even though it's just two people accepted Islam. I didn't stop and tell you about Yani Abu Dharr accepting Islam as important as Abu Dharr radiallahu anhu is, and we'll probably tell the story since I said that because I don't want it to be taken the wrong way. I didn't stop and tell you the story of the Islam of every single person. Now, right now there's 60, 70, 100, 200 Muslims. I didn't tell you the story of everyone, but I told you the story of Hamza, and I'll tell you the story of Umar. Why? Because the impact they had on the Muslims, because how they felt once these people accepted Islam. It wasn't just the physical strength. It was way more than that. Because physicality can only go so far. Right, one person, how many people can he take out? At the end, the numbers will win. It was the mental strength, the psychological strength, the spiritual strength that these people brought, the confidence, right? That grit, that boldness that they had. They were bold people. That left, he said, in kana, this is what he says, Ibn Mas'ud, I'm just quoting him. In kana islamu Umar la fatha. وهجرته لنصرة وإمارته رحمة والله ما استطعنا أن نصلي بالبيت حتى أسلم عمر فلما أسلم عمر قاتلهم حتى دعونا فصلينا. Said indeed the Islam of Umar was fath, was an opening for all of us, and when he did hijrah it was victory for all of us, and when he became an amir later on, when he became the khalifa, it was all mercy and compassion. Wallahi, we were not able, Ibn Mas'ud is saying, we weren't able to pray in front of the Kaaba openly until Umar became a Muslim, because he fought them off for us. He went and he fought them to make sure that we had the right to pray there. The Prophet ﷺ saw the energy in the room when he accepted Islam radiallahu anhu. He saw that the Kabir people were happy. Hamza was hugging him. They were very happy. So he said, okay, let's continue the lesson. فقال عمر, يا رسول الله, هلا جهرنا بها. Why don't we go and we publicly speak of what it is that we are learning here? Sayyidina Umar was all, he was full of that zest. So the Prophet عليه الصلاة والسلام قال, نعم, yes, we will. So he put them in two lines. Hamza on front of one, and Umar in front of the other. And he in the right in the middle, عليه الصلاة والسلام. And they left the house of Al-Arqam بالتكبير والتهليل. They would walk out with La ilaha illallah, Allahu akbar wa lillahi alhamd, La ilaha illallah, Allahu akbar wa lillahi alhamd. And Quraysh is like, what? What are you, who? What is this? So everyone out of their homes, how dare they? They walk out, they see Umar and Hamza, they go back in and close the door. It's okay, they'll be done soon. They'll be done soon. قَالَ فَذَهَبْنَا فَطُفْنَا بِالْبَيْتِ. They went and they performed tawaf. And no one touched them that day. And they went home. Umar al-Khattab was not done though. This is the value of someone who, when they commit to something, they commit. See, it doesn't matter if you're late. It doesn't matter if you're late. You can be late. As long as when you get there, the amount, the degree of commitment and grit that you carry is at that level. See, Umar was 6 years late. That's a long time. Out of 23 years, six is more than 25%. Huh? He missed more than a quarter of his time with the Prophet عليه الصلاة والسلام. But all we know today is Rasulullah wa ma'ahu Abu Bakr wa Umar. That's what Anas used to say. ذهب كان رسول الله يذهب وأبو بكر وعمر ويأتي وأبو بكر وعمر ويجلس وأبو بكر وعمر. He went عليه الصلاة والسلام, Abu Bakr Umar with him. He came back with him. How did he make it? Based on seniority, he would have taken him a long time. Yeah, it's not always about seniority. It doesn't always matter how long you've been there. Sometimes it's the effect that you have, the degree of commitment that you show. So radiallahu anhu, immediately when they're finished that, he goes to his home. He gathers all of his family, his wives, his children, their children. He had a big family, and he stood in front of them and he said, look, وَجْهِي مِنْ وَجْهِكُمْ حَرَامٌ حَتَّى تَشْهَدُوا أَنْ لَا إِلَٰهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ وَأَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا عَبْدُهُ وَرَسُولُهُ. I will not look at you, your faces again, and you're not a part of my family until you all say لا إله إلا الله محمد رسول الله. So they all said لا إله إلا الله محمد رسول الله. No one dared say a word except one, his son Abdullah. He didn't say anything. So he looks at his son, said, مَا بَالُكْ, why aren't you saying? فَقَالَ أَنَا مُسْلِمٌ ذُو أَعْوَامٍ. I've been Muslim for years. So he beats him. So he starts hitting him. يقول, مَا بَالُكْ, why are you hitting me? فَقَالَ كُنْتَ تُسْلِمْ وَتَتْرُكُ أَبَاكْ. You were going to go and become Muslim and leave your father. You found truth and you were going to take it for yourself and leave me. وَتَدَعُنِي لِجَهَنَّمْ. You let me to go to Jahannam, no problem, but you go to Jannah. قَالَ فَمَا زَالَ عُمَرْ إِذَا ذَكَرَهَا رُبَّمَا نَخَزَهُ النَّخْزَ. They said that Umar later on in his life, if any point, Abdullah ibn Umar became a man and became one of the biggest scholars of our history. One of the four abadila, most of the fiqh we have today come through his transmission. The hadith that we have come through his transmission. Very respected sahabi, radiallahu anhu. But later on, 20 years later, 30 years later, if Umar was sitting around and remembered, he would kick Abdullah. And he would say, well, why are you kicking? كنت تترك أباك. You'd leave your father, huh? You accept Islam and leave your father. Radiallahu anhu warda. But that wasn't enough. So he goes. And at this point, he doesn't know all the details, so he wants to pick a fight. He was upset with himself of how long it took him, and he felt the beauty of what he just found, and he wanted to push the agenda a bit, push the envelope. So he goes, and he knocks on the door of Abu Sufyan, Sakhr ibn Harb. So Abu Sufyan opens the door. Sayyidina Umar, he says, Ahlan wa sahlan, Umar, nice to see you. فقال يا أبو سفيان إني أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأني أن محمد رسول الله. He gives the shahada. فقال تبا لك سائر اليوم أفسدت علي يومي. That you ruined my day. And he closes the door and locks it. Didn't get anything out of this. So he goes out to the house of Abu Jahl, Abu Hakam ibn Hisham. And he knocks on the door. Abu Jahl opens the door. أهلا وسهلا عمر. How are you today? إني أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأن محمدا عبده ورسوله. قال أفسدت علي يومي. You ruined my day. And he closes the door and he knocks the door. He's not getting anything out of this. So he goes رضي الله عنه and he stands in the middle of the Kaaba, right in front of the Kaaba, and he starts to announce his shahada, and he starts to challenge the people of Quraysh. قال حتى اجتمعوا عليه, until they all came. Yeah, he's only one person, but 5, 6, 7, 8. Once there were enough of them, they tried. قال فقاتله فقاتلوه فقاتلهم. So they start to fight him, so he fought them back. قال فما زال يقاتلهم حتى الزوال. Like he fought them from the morning until the dhuhr time. قال فكان كلما تعب أخذ برأس أحدهم. Every time he got tired from fighting them, he would find one of them, he would take him by the head, and then he would take his fingers and put it on his eyeballs. And he would say, tell them to leave me or I'll pop your eyeballs. So the guy would say, please leave him. So they would all leave him. And he would sit there holding his head, resting for a few moments, radiallahu anhu. And then when he was done, he would let them go and he would fight them again. قال فما زال كذلك حتى العصر. He did that for a couple of more hours, radiallahu anhu warda. قال ثم تركوه وذهب. Then they left him and they went. And that's how Umar al-Khattab accepted Islam. That's not how he decided to do it. Everyone's different. That's how he decided to do it. He came in with a bang. He left an impact. This story is not to encourage violence of any sort, obviously. You understand where this is coming from. What I'm more interested in is the amount of passion that he carried, radiallahu anhu, when he accepted it. How far he was willing to go. Remember we talked about Abu Bakr? And I told you, Abu Bakr, within the first 2 days of Islam, brought 7 of the 10 Mubashireen bil Jannah and Bilal ibn Rabah. Imagine these names that he brought to Islam. This is before he even knew, beyond anything beyond al-Fatiha. And iqra bismi rabbik. That's all he knew. He had no Islamic knowledge yet. Very simple. Just basic stuff, because it was right the second day. It was the passion that they had. The difference is the passion. The difference is the love they had for Islam when they understood it. When it touched their hearts and they found this beauty, they found this profoundness, they loved it. And that love motivated them passionately to take it to others. And Abu Bakr is different than Umar. They didn't do it the same way. Umar confronted and he pushed back the oppressors and he fought back the persecutors. Abu Bakr went and did da'wah. But what they have in common is the passion they had to Islam, even though they were very different as people. Abu Bakr was a thin, slender gentleman. Umar al-Khattab was a door of a man. Sayyidina Abu Bakr was very soft in his speech. Umar al-Khattab was extremely, and he was just very, very direct. But what they had in common was that passion. And that's what's missing. What's missing is the passion. Is the love. Is the love for Islam that's what we're missing. Is to love it that way. Love it to the point where you're willing to give your life. You're willing to do everything you can to help other people also see the beauty in it. Because it's not about me or you. It's not a story about Umar or about... It's about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the message He is sending to His creation. If you understand the message and you see the beauty in that message, and you see the beauty of the relationship you have with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, understanding Allah jalla jalaluhu, and being close to Him, that beauty is something that you want others to experience, to have the opportunity to enjoy and to embrace. So you go and you try your best to make sure someone else can take it. That's why, till this day, Muslims, you know, we've fallen off the path quite a bit, but we still find true joy when someone accepts Islam, right? Like, no matter how far you are away from Allah, the moment someone accepts Islam, you're happy. You celebrate because you know that they are now going to enjoy the beauty that you're enjoying. Even though maybe you're not practicing it well. Maybe you're not actually taking advantage of it and you're not adhering to it appropriately. You know deep inside that this is the right thing. I'm not doing great, but I know it's beautiful. I would like others to enjoy it as well. We still carry that. It's just the passion has been dulled down a little bit over the years. It would be beautiful if we were able to bring some of that back. Especially for our younger generation. Especially for my younger brothers and sisters. To find that passion, to find the beauty in what it means to be Muslim, and to dedicate your life to making sure that you not only understand it and learn it, but can help others appreciate it as well, and practice it and learn it. And that comes in many forms. So let's summarize a little bit where we are right now so we can move on. In the midst of all of this, as they continue to be persecuted, It doesn't stop with his Islam, radiallahu anhu, but some changes occurred, enough for them to feel like there was an impact. But they were still being persecuted. They were still being silenced. They were still being mistreated. Some people were being killed. The number of Muslims that were killed in Mecca was, by that time, over 20. No war is occurring, just people being tortured to death or killed. Over 20 by year number 6. It's a lot, if you consider the number of Muslims altogether, which wasn't very high. The number of Muslims wasn't very high. So 20 was a pretty big number. And the way that the Sahaba are looking at it is that this is taking long. This is taking longer than maybe they expected. Longer than maybe they thought it was going to take. 6 years now, and we're still not gaining a lot of ground here, not making the progress that we feel we should be making. So the morale in general is low. They never used violence. It was not a part of their teachings, because the Prophet ﷺ was very clear. Umar al-Khattab, in that story I'm telling you, he didn't know yet. It wasn't all explained to him. This never happened again. Once he was sat down and things were explained, he never did it again. But off the bat, he didn't know yet. So he got that free that free trial. But there was a real problem in how the Sahaba were feeling regarding their state and where they were. And it was becoming quite difficult. And the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, the lessons he was teaching were lessons that today I think more than ever are extremely important for us to think about and to contemplate. You see, righteousness will always prevail eventually. And fake currencies in this world will not. You have to have full certainty in this. You should have no doubt in the fact that righteousness will always prevail. It's always worth living for that which is the truth, for that which is correct and right. And all that works against righteousness, all that is false, all that is a lie, these are fake currencies that eventually will cease to exist and they will disappear. And Surah Al-Ra'd was revealed during this period to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. And within it, the ayah, أَنْزَلَ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً. This is an example that the Sahaba are being given from the Qur'an during a time where the most powerful lessons the Sahaba received when they were being persecuted. And the verses that asked them to sacrifice the most were verses that were revealed during the time of Mecca when they were being persecuted. The verses that required sacrifice, high degrees of sacrifice, didn't come in Medina when they had a lot. It came in Mecca when they had nothing. So they would learn the importance of giving, of doing your best, of offering, of not being, don't sit down and wait for things to get better, for you to get better. Because that mentality is toxic and is problematic, and a lot of us live like that. I'll become better when things get better. No, you don't know if things are going to get better. You don't know. What you know is right now, you have right now. Be the best you can be right now, because there is no later or waiting. There's nothing to wait for, because you don't know what's coming anyways. So they were told in the midst of persecution, in the midst of their darkness, they were told to give their best and to stand by righteousness and to sacrifice themselves and their lives and their wealth. And that's the lesson that we have to understand. We have to go back to that. We have to go back to that. And if you can learn that young, you can go far in your life. If you don't wait for things to happen, if you're not waiting for something to change so you can change, just now, what needs to happen now? Then do it. How can you be better? Then go ahead, be better now, not later. أَنْزَلَ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً فَسَالَتْ أَوْدِيَةٌ بِقَدَرِهَا فَاحْتَمَلَ السَّيْلُ زَبَدًا رَّابِيًا وَمِمَّا يُوقِدُونَ عَلَيْهِ فِي النَّارِ ابْتِغَاءَ حِلْيَةٍ أَوْ مَتَاعٍ زَبَدٌ مِثْلُهُ كَذَلِكَ يَضْرِبُ اللَّهُ الْحَقَّ وَالْبَاطِلَ. So Allah says, here's the example I'm going to give you of righteousness and falsehood. You see, when a river runs and foam forms on top of the river, it's foam, it's nothing. Leaves and dirt and something that has no value at all. But it's what you see when you look at the river. When you look at the river, that's all you see. You don't see the water. You see the foam. And he said, you see when a blacksmith is trying to, or someone who works with gold, when they are subjecting gold to high degrees of heat and they liquefy it, what happens on the top is that you get this black stuff, this garbage that you have to scoop off and get rid of. It's like scum on the top of the gold. That's what you can see. You can't see the gold's under it, but you can see that scum. It says, this is the example of haqq and batil. فَأَمَّا الزَّبَدْ فَيَذْهَبُ جُفَاءً. As for the foam and that scum on top, it goes. It's thrown away. It gets lost. وَأَمَّا مَا يَنْفَعُ النَّاسِ. However, that which benefits people, فَيَمْكُثُ فِي الْأَرْضِ. It stays in earth. The water sinks deep and it takes care of the roots. And that gold has value. That gold people will hold on to and it'll give them a means for a livelihood. كَذَلِكَ يَضْرِبُ اللَّهُ الْأَمْثَالِ This is how Allah gives you the examples. Don't be fooled by the appearance of batil in the world. Don't be fooled by how batil is on the surface. How falsehood seems to, when you look at it, seems to have strength and have power and have wealth and have... It's foam. It's scum on the surface. Real good righteousness, goodness is under. It'll take time, but it's there. It's there. And it's worth living for. And it's worth fighting for. And it will prevail. You just have to stand by it long enough. Sometimes long enough means your life. Sometimes your whole life, and you don't live, and it happens after you're gone. I mean, you don't see the day when that beam of light comes from the horizon. You don't live long enough to see the light at the end of the tunnel. You don't. But it's worth living for. And that's what he was teaching them, alayhi salatu wasalam. And that's the lesson that we have to take time and learn. Dar al-Arqam. It's a beautiful part of his seerah, alayhi salatu wasalam, is understanding Dar al-Arqam. Because today we use it as there's a lot of institutions and masajid that call it because it's a beautiful name. Al-Arqam, Ibn Abi al-Arqam, is a sahabi from Mecca, a young gentleman whose parents had passed away when he was young and he was around 17, 18 when he accepted Islam. And at that point he was an adult, so he had his own home. He didn't have to live with others, he had his own house. Still young and wasn't married yet. And he didn't have a lot of wealth, but what he offered the Muslims, what he offered the Prophet ﷺ was a place for them to gather, a quiet, secret place for them to have their lectures and have their learnings. So he offered his home. And for years, for all these years, from basically year number two or one or two, till the time he leaves Mecca, alayhi salatu wasalam, all of the meetings with the Sahaba, all where they sit and they have their lectures and they have their teaching, they talk about, happens in Dar al-Arqam. We have very little narrations from Dar al-Arqam, unfortunately. We have very few narrations that come out of Dar al-Arqam, very few, almost none, that you can call authentic. One of the things that I hope one day to be able to, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will show us, is I would like to see. I would love to just watch what was happening in that room, in that house. How the Prophet alayhi salam was educating the Sahaba. Sometimes the stuff you really learn, you don't remember in terms of a quote. Like you don't walk away, this is what he was saying. You're learning it, you're internalizing the idea. You internalize it, it becomes a part of who you are, it becomes second nature to you, you live it. And that's what the Sahaba did. What they learned in Dar al-Arqam, they impersonated. They personified, it manifests in their lives. They didn't come and say, this is what he said. This happened later on in Medina. In Medina, there was way more people. He was talking way more publicly. People memorized things he would say and they would pass it on. But in Mecca, the lessons they were learning from him, alayhi salatu wasalam, were for behavior, for action, for implementation. So they did, they implemented them. But it must have been a beautiful thing to have existed in Dar al-Arqam with the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, and learned from him during those years. In al-Arqam, that's all he had. He didn't have a lot to offer. He offered his home. Out of loyalty to him, the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, when they went to Medina, the first thing he did is he bought a house for al-Arqam. The first thing he did, the wealth of the Muslims, he bought him a house, his own house. Not everyone had their own house. Most Sahaba lived with others. Now al-Arqam. He lived alone. He had his own home. Because out of loyalty to the person who offered his house for 10 years, putting himself at risk. Putting himself and putting his home at risk. Because they took it away, they confiscated his house, Kuffar Quraysh, and they burned it down and they built their own homes on top of it. And he never had it again. We don't even know where it is in Mecca, clearly. There are some narrations, but we don't know for sure. And during this time, the Prophet ﷺ would explain surahs. I always like to point out some surahs for you, just for your own benefit. Because these surahs were revealed to him early on, ﷺ, and the Sahaba in Dar al-Arqam got to listen to them and got to learn them. Surah Sa'd was revealed early on, during Dar al-Arqam. Surah Sa'd, at the end of that page, was the first time they would hear a specific word. Anyone know what the word is? The first time the Sahaba would hear a specific word in the Qur'an. No, it's on the page over there. Anyone know? The first time a specific word was used, they'd never heard that word before. It's going to be a big word within the explanation of what we are as human beings and who we are as people. What are job descriptions, huh? Khalifa. Yes, Khalifa. Ya Dawoodu, inna ja'alnaka khalifatan fil ard. The first time they heard the word Khalifa. Khalifa as a successor, as someone who takes responsibility for something on behalf of someone else. And this is the story of the human being. We are khulafa on earth. That's what Adam was told. Inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa is what Allah said to the malaika about Adam. That's what you are. The Sahaba had not heard that word yet. in the Quran, sequentially, you open the Quran, the first time is ayah number 30 in Surah Al-Baqarah. But in terms of revelation, the first time they heard the word was Surah Sad, when they were in Dar al-Arqam, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talked about Dawood alayhi salam as the example of Khalifa. And he would use the term, فَحْكُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ بِالْحَقِّ وَلَا تَتَّبِعِ الْهَوَى. Two things. You must, when you judge only with righteousness. وَلَا تَتَّبِعِ الْهَوَى. And you never follow your whims or desires. That's what you're going to need in order to be Khalifa. And Dawood specifically was chosen because Dawood is a really awesome example. Dawood alayhi salam, jazakallahu khair. Dawood alayhi salam was a king. And he was an army leader. He was a politician. He was a prophet. He was a haddad. He was a blacksmith. He was a scientist. He was someone who sat down and did experiments on metals. He was an artist. His voice was so beautiful that the mountains and the birds would sing with him, radiallahu anhu. He was a father, and he was a son, and he was a spouse. Dawood was chosen as the example for the first time for them to hear Khalifa, because he fulfilled a lot of roles. He fulfilled almost all of the roles. That's why if you take Dawood as an example and you study him, you find the Prophet ﷺ says things like this. He says, خَيْرُ الصَّلَاتِ أو خَيْرُ صَلَاتُ دَوُودِ. The best prayer schedule at night was the prayer schedule of Dawood. كَانَ يَنَامُ نِصْفَ اللَّيْلِ ثُمَّ يَقُومُ سُدُسَهُ وَثُلُثَهُ ثُمَّ يَنَامُ السُدُسِ. He would sleep half the night and then pray a third and then sleep a sixth. That's what he did every night. قَالْ وَخَيْرُ الصِّيَامِ صِيَامُ دَوُودِ. The hadith is Muslim. And the best fasting schedule, the fasting of Dawood. كَانَ يَصُومُ يَوْمًا وَيُفْطُرُ يَوْمًا. Day in, one day he would fast, the other day he would break fast, day in, day out, all his life. And then another hadith with the Prophet tells us a long story how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala showed Adam alayhi salam all of his children before he passed away. He saw all of his children. And he saw all of us. And he saw between the eyes of each and every one of us a certain light. And he's looking at all of his children and he sees one light that stands out to him. Of course, there's too many of us, so he has no idea but he sees one light that kind of is shining too brightly. So he's like, who is that? Who's the one who has that light? Fayaqulullah, that is your son Dawood. So he asks him, how long does he live? He says he lives 60 years. So Adam would say, that's not enough. Give him 40 from my life. So he gave him 40 from his life. And then when he came to die, Sayyidina Adam, he was like, I have more years. He said, no, you give him to Dawood. They wanted to take him back, but he couldn't. Because he gave him his word. But he saw something in Dawood alayhi salam. Dawood is the example of someone who fulfilled all of these roles. He was called Khalifa. And that's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be those who see ourselves as responsible caregivers, as caregivers of the earth and everyone on it, to the best of our ability. What's your capacity? Are you a father? You're a caregiver there. Are you a spouse? You're a caregiver there. Are you a son? Are you a sibling? Are you an employee? Are you an employer? Are you a student? Are you a friend? What are you? You're a lot of things. Whatever you are, you're a caregiver in all of those roles. A mother, a sister, a daughter. Whatever you do, you're a caregiver. Make sure that you feel that responsibility, that ownership. You see, if we felt that, we wouldn't be where we are right now as an ummah. If we felt that we were caregivers and we were responsible, we wouldn't be where we are. Where we are right now as an ummah comes from the fact that we don't feel like we have ownership. Someone else will take care of it. The sheikh will do it. Or that organization will do it. Someone else will figure this out. We don't feel that it's our responsibility. Someone else will, it's not my responsibility. Why? Why is it not your responsibility? Who said it wasn't? Who said it was someone else's? Who gave them that designation? You think God is still giving designations out of what we should do? Huh? I just sit here because you allow me to. There's nothing about me. I'm nothing. You can throw me out and get someone else. There's nothing special about any of us. Aside from your sense of responsibility and ownership of what this story is. So they got to hear that word Khalifa. And for a while they talked about that. The word would later on be explained in more detail as time went on. But that was the first time they got to hear it. That was very meaningful. Surah Al-Asr, the one that you recite on almost every salah. Because you love it, not because of anything. You love the surah. And you have every light to it. It's a beautiful surah. It's very beautiful. It is really beautiful. He swears by time. He makes an oath by time. I swear by time. Al-Asr, not Surah Al-Asr. Time. Asr is time. Indeed, the human being is in a state of constant loss. Of what? He never takes an oath uselessly, subhanahu wa ta'ala. When he makes an oath, it's always a reason. He's swearing by time, and he's telling you you're in a state of constant loss of time. But not everyone. إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالصَّبْرِ. Those who figure out what they're here to do, they believe in Allah and they do the deeds they're here to do, and then they do one more thing. تَوَاصَوْا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاصَوْا بِالصَّبْرِ. Tawasa means they exchange information, they exchange advice, they exchange expertise, they exchange wisdom. Bilhaq, regarding things that are worth dying for. And the sabr, things that are worth living for. The exchange. That's how you win time. That mentorship, that togetherness, where it's a two-way road, where I offer you what I have, you offer me what you got. And then we build on each other and we learn. And we win time because you've done things in your life that I haven't. And if you show me how to do certain things, I win time. People who go and try to get paperwork done in a Middle Eastern government offices know exactly what I'm talking about. If you're given an udbara, you ever see the blue udbara? They give you a little bit of it's a small paper holder, and you're walking into a governmental office, yani building, and you have to get this done. It's like jihad fi sabilillah elsewhere is much easier than doing this. And you walk in, and before you waste 3 years of your life trying to get the paperwork, some person walks out, just finished, says, here, let me tell you exactly what to do. You win time. Instead of wasting 3 years, he'll win you time. This is the beauty of life. You can win time if you listen. Tawaso meaning I'm accepting and giving. It's not wawasso, that one group tells, I'm not here just to tell you things, I'm here to listen to you too. So that I learn, so I grow, so I win time too. Or else I'm losing. If I'm only talking, then I'm losing. But we have to have that mentality, that every person sitting here is a gem, who has expertise, who has something to offer. Young or old, makes no difference. Everyone has something to offer. And if we benefited, and if we mentored one another, and if we worked, and if we had that sense of togetherness, we could win so much time. It's like you're walking, I come back from a route that was a dead end, and you're just starting, and I say, listen, and then you keep on going. إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَفِي خُسْرٍ. You're going to waste. I already wasted years. Why do you have to? You understand why parents get upset when their kids don't listen to them? This is why they get upset. Because whether you know it or not, and I'll tell you the secret, most of the mistakes you're going to make, your parents already made before you. They won't say it. They won't admit to it. Not under the threat of a gun, they won't admit it. But they did. They wasted time. They made mistakes. So when they see you walking down a path that they've already walked down, that doesn't lead to anything good, they get very upset. No, don't do this. And you're like, you want to take away my freedom. No. Ya Fahman. Ya Aqil. It's not that they don't want your freedom, because they made that mistake already. Don't let their mistake in their life be in vain. Learn. Take something so you can win time. Win time. We win time. If I took the experience from you, then instead of having to spend 15 years, that's why when you read a book, it's so important, because a book has a life experience of another human being. Instead of having to live that life to learn these lessons, you read and you win time. The human being is in a constant state of loss of time. Except those who do the right thing and then exchange experiences. And that is what really, this ayah, this surah was revealed right before Isra' al-Mi'raj, which is the time that we're in right now. Now we still have a bit until we come to Isra' al-Mi'raj, but this was revealed just around that time. Like I said, these surahs that I'm explaining to you, these surahs were revealed to the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, I only know within a vicinity of 2 years, like a range of a year and a half when it was revealed. So I'll talk about this again, inshallah, once we talk about Isra' al-Mi'raj. Do we have the kahoot? So we'll end with that, inshallah ta'ala. We'll continue with inshallah ta'ala next week. We'll try and get to the negotiation period before we start the prep for Ramadan. Tomorrow morning, inshallah ta'ala, after Fajr, we have a potluck breakfast. Basically, I give a small dars, and then people eat. The men usually here, and the sisters in the front. It is a potluck, so everyone has to bring. Yes.